Welcome, everyone. We have an exciting topic this morning, History of Holacracy with Lex and Brian. And I just wanted to take a moment to introduce Lex and Brian as two out of the three founders of Holacracy One. Really happy to have you guys here this morning to talk about your experience of what it was like to develop Holacracy, because you are also two out of the three founders who formed the software company that pioneered the formation of this tool. And you're also a wonderful husband and wife team who've been working together for over a decade, and I personally think that's quite an accomplishment. So thank you for being here with us today, and a larger framing of thanks really is also for following this inquiry through thick and thin to get us to a point of birthing a new technology for human organization. And I'm personally really curious to hear how Holacracy evolved, as well as, you know, what some of the influence have been in the evolution of Holacracy. And just for our listeners here today and later, if you listen to the recording, that we'll be continuing this inquiry in future calls with more in-depth dives into some of the core influencing systems, models like Getting Things Done, Agile Software, and Integral Typologies, as well as others. So stay tuned. We'll have more. So to get us rolling today, I thought I'd ask one of the questions that's been cooking for me for some time, which is, I'd love to hear more about that initial spark of curiosity that launched this investigation. What experience and what kind of experiences contributed to the formation of the inquiry itself?
Yeah, well, I'll start. You know, for me, there was just it came at a time in my life when we started that software company that I had just been so turned off of organizations in so many ways. There was just a deep sense of, oh my God, there's just got to be a better way. This is nuts. I had kind of gone through a few years on the tail of being really excited and loving what I was doing in different organizations. I think my eyes started opening up to the limits of them, and I had gone through a several year period of just feeling like, oh my God, there's so much here that is limiting our ability to express, to contribute, everything we have to offer, that wasn't embracing both our capacity and our full range of skills and talents, and wasn't allowing us to integrate together in the most effective ways I could envision or imagine. And I wasn't quite sure how to resolve a lot of those things, but it was really a spark of dissatisfaction at first. That changed over time, but at first it was just this, my God, there's got to be a better way. There's just got to be something better than this. And that led to starting the software company originally.
I think there might have been just a little bit of your arrogant youthfulness. There's got to be, this is definitely stupid. We can build it better. We, you know, this is our first company out of the gate.
It's after a couple of years of trying to build your own business, it beats the youthful arrogance right out of you. When we realize, oh my God, this is actually hard. this is just easy. No wonder it's been so difficult in other organizations. There's no easy answer. This is hard.
Gotcha. Well, what were some of the earliest experiments that you tried?
Let's see. So we started the software company. I think actually one of the other foundational spark pieces has to do with the typologies that you referenced. My colleague and mentor, Linda Behrens, who I've worked with and learned from in the type world, she's now calling them integral type and her method, the integral type method. But at the time, it wasn't named that. That was well before that branding. Nonetheless, we had all of the founders of the software company, Lex and I in particular, from actually well before we were even married, in our developing relationship, we used these type models to better understand each other, to better connect, to better integrate together. And, you know, it was from looking at, through this lens of a really good type model. And I should caveat, there are a lot of really bad type models out there, and there's a lot of really poor ways of using type models out there. And they're often used in ways that limit, label, box, stereotype. And I think the ways, the particular lineage of typologies that we came from had a much, much more powerful frame and way of holding them and more powerful models. And from that work, we had really grown to appreciate that we each have different lenses that we naturally see and interpret the world through, and different energies we bring and talents we bring. And one of the driving questions for me at the very beginning of this journey was, how do we integrate and embrace all of these different energies and the value that all of these different energies brought? And in the very early days, it was a sense of, my God, you know, I want to do that to better embrace us, the people. But soon into that journey, I realized there's something much more powerful and compelling here than even that. It's even when there's not some individual human there showing up with a certain type or certain energy, that energy is still needed. I mean, everybody else needs it as well. As Lex said early in our relationship, we have very opposite, in many ways, interaction styles, ways of engaging the world and of interacting. And she had to kind of beat into my thick head early in our relationship that the point of integrating and meeting her needs was not just to meet her needs. It's because it actually helped meet my own needs better as well. I was just blind to it. It was shadowed. And it took a long time to understand that. So with that wisdom, as we started the software company, came the question, what happens, how do we build a company that takes all of these different energies and perspectives and lenses and doesn't let any one of them dominate, but holds a space rather for all of them? What is possible to create in that environment? Lex, anything to add? And also, Lex, your mic, you might want to get it close to your mouth. You were really hard to understand earlier. Now we can't hear you at all, Lex. So whatever you tried didn't work. Go ahead. Okay. It was was a major foundational point. And the interesting thing was, into that journey, we realized it wasn't enough to just hold the idea or the principles of these type models. It needed to be embodied in the actual practices of the organization, and that took many years to work out. But that was some of the core motivation from the beginning, and has stuck with it. As those who have been through our certification training know, we take just a little piece of those models and we offer it in the certification training to help people get a sense of their own bias and how this system overall integrates many different competing polarities, or at least polarities that look competing and that are in most organizations. And by harnessing all of them, we get a much more powerful dynamic than if we just collapse to an either or in the different energies.
Yeah. So interesting. It sounds like that one of the earliest experiments might have been around these kind of how do you integrate all of these different typologies into a work environment. Did your experiments have, what kind of structure did they have to them?
And this goes back to even before we started the software company. We were on that journey, and it looked at, the simplest ways, give everybody common language and lenses to use. Well, that didn't fully guarantee the integration. So, Okay, how about different meeting processes? At that time, we had, we would have Linda out, and she'd try it. Linda was, again, our kind of mentor and coach in these areas. And she'd run a meeting process with us of some sort, of various sorts. We'd try a lot of different things. And it would it was one of many kind of roads or experiments. It's hard to continue down that one without weaving in some of the others that started influencing. But that was definitely a core, and I think continues to this day as a lens, a measurement lens. When we're looking at this system, one of the lenses I always bring and use is, does this, if I take the perspective of all of these different, in our models, temperaments, interaction styles, and all of the different cognitive dynamics that different people use, cognitive processes, if you can try on each of those lenses, what does this look like? Does it embrace the gifts of all of them? As Linda says, does it generally embrace all of the gifts or needs without anyone being in pain for too long? Because whenever you're dealing with these polarities, somebody, you're dealing with their opposites as well. So you do expect people to be uncomfortable with parts of the system. You don't want a system that any one person is completely comfortable with, or you are missing something. You want a system that integrates all of these polarities and gets the value of all of them. So it's still, to this day, a measurement I use as Holacracy continues to evolve to look at and say, is this, are we at the right thing here?
Mm-hmm. Can you guys hear me better now?
Yeah, great.
Much better. Okay. That's great.
Just to add to that a little bit, I think some of it is, I guess just with anything, Holacracy, the type stuff, was we practiced. So it wasn't, some of it was an experimentation as much as it was a refinement through practice. Though with Ternary, we had a really good culture of improvement. We had a lot of folks that were really interested in improvement and were very patient and very willing to experiment on themselves and each other. And we had, some of the things we had were, we'd have like weekly company meetings where, or regular groups where we would sit and talk about these things, like maybe we would read a book or something like that. So we really had it in the culture so that we could tweak it and experiment with it. And it was harder because it wasn't quite as repeatable, especially at the beginning, but I think the culture really supported it enough that we were able to tweak and experiment and just try things out and see how that worked. Embed the language, the type language in and try it and see how that helped us day to day.
How did you know what to try? What did that process look like?
Brian would bring stuff in and we would all try it.
Yeah, it was in the early years of that company. It was just trying to absorb all of the different ideas we could and figure out what piece can we use from them. So we brought in, got into Barry Oshry's work, and that gave us some new lenses to better see and understand different power dynamics in organization. That was really interesting. And then we found Peter Senge's work and learning organizations, and that gave us some interesting frames. Mm-hmm. What a lot of those things lacked is concrete processes. Right. But in the early days, we weren't there yet. It was really trying to absorb new mental models and kind of just, it was almost like we were collecting different lenses to use to look at and understand organization. Mm-hmm. And just as many as we can and then embed them into the culture so that we can kind of all look through them and understand better what's going on and use that understanding individually. Still a long way away from what Holacracy would eventually become, which is not just a cultural thing of human understanding, but built into the processes. Mm-hmm. Where we first started venturing into the land of processes was with agile software development. That was our first bridge beyond just all these different lenses of looking at an understanding and moving into what processes do we use that we can look at through these lenses and say, yes, these meet all these new standards and all that. It really took that next step of actual looking at process.
So what was it that Agile contributed? What was the kind of process it brought to the table, the concrete item?
Yeah, several pieces, I guess. One, what we now talk about is dynamic steering. That is absolutely core to Agile. And they have different places in the Agile world have different degrees to which they actually explicitly communicate that or more just talk around it, but it is core no matter what. And that's my bicycle metaphor. The steering, the bicycle metaphor, that came right from the Agile space. That was a metaphor used in the context of a car. In Kent Beck's book, which is one of the seminal books in the Agile space, and I changed it to a bicycle because it seemed an even better example to me. And actually, I think he's used it that way as well. Yeah. And so that whole dynamic steering principle got baked into practice in Agile with project management practices, as well as some of the more detailed software development practices we used. Although I'll spare the listener the technical details, the project management processes were ones that since that's almost closer to how we organize, some of those practices they're very much based on things that you hear in our trainings like cues and pulling from cues as opposed to pushing, facing reality ruthlessly and adapting continually, shortening cycles. Go ahead, Bex.
Shortening feedback loops, cycles to release. Traditionally in software development, you could have a release of software that would take a year to build out, and that's what these guys were pushing against, and they're finding out that this isn't working. So it's shorter release, more feedback, getting more data, quickly, putting software in front of the customers so that they can see it and getting the feedback that way. So not hiding from reality and not trying to design. Big design up front and what's called waterfall project management is really what agile software development pushes against, which is this idea that we don't want to over-engineer because we might not need it later. Travel light, you might not need it later. Mm-hmm. Just do the minimum that can possibly work, that sort of thing.
And the concept of what the agile software world called big design up front, where we spend all this upfront energy predicting and trying to design the perfect answer or solution or process or whatever, and then we try to implement it, only to face reality and discover that's not actually what was needed, and we wasted a large chunk of our time doing it. Mm-hmm. And this is habitual to organizations and humans well beyond the software space, right? I mean, how many times have you found yourself crafting this thing, designing something you thought would be great, putting lots of time and energy in, and then you go to the ultimate stakeholder in this thing, or you deploy it, or you ship it, and then you find out, you know what, that's not really what they needed. It's not quite right. Okay, but it misses the main thing they wanted. And it's just so much wasted time from big design up front. And, what Agile did was introduce lots of practices to avoid that and what to replace it with, which is deliver early and often, get lots of feedback, partner with your clients. The whole idea of partnership in stakeholder relationships, I think, came for us originally from Agile, where you treat the client not just as somebody arm's length to contract with and deliver to, but as a core member of the development team. And I think you can extend that same metaphor to any number of relationships. And even now, Holacracy One has double links across organizations with our licensees. So instead of treating them as an external party that we are trying to satisfy, we instead invite them in to process their own tensions, which shifts the power dynamic quite a bit and is a much more powerful way of integrating feedback. So all of that stemmed from practices in the Agile space. I think the other thing that's really worth pointing out is the way teams are managed in the Agile space. So the concept of a self-organizing circle came for us right from Agile. So the Agile world has a strong focus on your software development team. Rather than directing them and trying to iron out process from above and hand it in, let them self-organize and figure out how their own processes are best evolved. Where the Agile software space often, I think, misses something is there's no governance process to do that. So it often becomes telling the team, self-organize, you're self-organizing, you're empowered, go. And without giving them the tools to use that and to govern around it, you have some issues. So that was one of the challenges we faced that led us on another path we can talk about in a minute. First, at least this concept of an autonomous, semi-autonomous, self-organizing circle that needed to take into account the broader organization's needs, absolutely, but also had to have its autonomy and authority to self-organize, that came directly from the Agile space. And we then took that and said, well, of course, that makes sense in all of our teams, software or whatever. So we had this concept of what we now call circles or self-organizing organizational units, cells of the organization. That, for us, originally came from the Agile space, and then we added other components and pieces to it.
Yeah, Deborah had a great question here, which is, did the employees generally like doing these experiments, the different things you tried, and how did it affect the workflow?
I think it varied for different people. I think we had a handful of people that loved it, that got really into it, that helped experiment with it. Though I think for the most part, the answer is probably no. I think there was a real love and appreciation of the kind of culture in which experimentation was welcomed and embraced, and the kind of culture where we were looking for new and better ways. However, the actual experimentation was very taxing. Things would change out from under you. It's one day we're doing it this way, the next day we've completely changed something core, and then the next day it's yet different, and you're always running to catch up. the sense of lack of stability in that was huge, and for good reason. There wasn't much stability in our methods and process because we were evolving them so damn quick. So it was very painful and very difficult to be in, extremely so. And I think that really took its toll on a lot of people. Some did not, it did not work. Some had to leave the organization. Some left on their own accord, very frustrated with that. Some we had to exit as they self-destructed in that system. And others thrived in it because they were learning and growing so much and developing through that process themselves, even as they found it quite painful at the same time. Some were able to find the value in that pain. But it was definitely painful. Let's all this. I love, you know, all the ideas in the world we have today that growth is some beautiful process, and there are you know, it's like the metaphors we use, trees and you know, sunlight, and I think true growth, when we are breaking a paradigm and developing something new, it is a shattering process. It is difficult. It is taxing. You know, and I think that really captured a lot of the feeling and energy. Now, the meaning we make of that is a separate matter. We can look at that as a beautiful process when we stand back from it and appreciate the opportunity to be in it. Or we can be in it and be in pain. But I do think there was a lot of pain in that organization from the continual experimentation. It would have been so much easier just to say, we're just going to run this company in a conventional way. I mean, God, it would have been easier.
For me, it was definitely a means to an end. And especially in those days, we hadn't quite nailed out the human as a sensor. So sometimes the pain is just pain that you need to feel. Well, it's always pain you need to feel, pretty much. But it could get very tiring, and we learned very early on that you could only run so many. I don't know why. Science knows this. We took us a while to figure it out. Scientifically trained in everything, our science was pretty bad in some cases. You can't run that many experiments at a time. What was that?
We would run 8 experiments at once.
We didn't know what was changing stuff. So it became, I think it was tiring after a while, but if you could really get into what you were doing and why you were doing it, it really helped a lot. But sometimes you just wanted to get your work done. You had clients that they just wanted software.
Well, Karen's got a great question here, you know, partnering with clients, you know, when do clients realize that you're doing things differently, being used to traditional tools, how did they react, you know, what was the client experience at the, you know, from all these experiments that were being conducted?
Yes. We definitely told them very early on that, I mean, we because in order to do agile software development properly, you really need to have their involvement, and you kind of need to tell them up front because they don't necessarily expect that. So I think a lot of that was done early in the sales process of setting expectations. And I don't think they completely understood, and there were some pieces they didn't like, but for the most part, they liked being able to get, because the focus of delivering software early and often is great, because then they can see that the stuff is happening, for one, and they can see how it's taking form, and they're spending a lot of money. Software is very expensive, and to be able to see your work product as it's coming out, rather than just getting a document of what it's going to look like for all that money, I think that they really liked that, and the control it allowed them to have, and just showing them, but there's a response. When they see it, then they can say, wow, that's really not what I thought I needed. Or you could show them partial stuff, and then they could give you feedback and say, well, I don't really need it to do all of that. I just need it to do this. And they can change what they're getting for their money, because it may be just cheaper to do it a different way that will work for them better anyway. So
I'll add to that. The client experience, I think, was generally very good, very positive. And it wasn't just expectation setting in the sales process. It was a sales tool. It wasn't just, hey, expect things are going to, you know, be sense and respond. It was, hey, the reason you want to use us is because we will enable your organization and software to have the capacity to sense and respond to your real market needs. And we did deliver on that really well. Yeah. So from the client point of view, I think it was a much more comfortable experience. That doesn't mean there wasn't a learning curve. There often was. Sometimes the initial expectations of the clients were for predict and control, and we had to help ease them into this new paradigm. So all of that was true and was there, but we did that, I think, quite well. Generally, the client experience, of course, always exceptions, and there were parts of it that maybe were a little stressful, but the overall client experience, I think, was quite well, and the capacity we brought to the clients was quite significant, much better than your typical outsourced software development with a predict and control approach. So that was the interesting paradox. And internally, I think the experience of being in a sense and respond process was actually quite positive as well for everybody within. That was part of what people loved about that company and being there. Mm-hmm. What was hard was the experimentation, so slightly different. It wasn't the idea of sense and respond or experiment a lot. It was the actual things changing constantly, even in how we sense and responded, because we're looking for better ways to sense and respond.
Yep.
So to be very concrete, you know, there was one, I think, about a 12-month or 18-month period where we went through five different salary systems, each one of which changed the way people were paid, changed the level of pay, changed the way pay was calculated, and we didn't negotiate it one-off with each person. We took a stand and said, nope, we are having generic systems that stay transparent and fair. Mm. So if we change the system, we apply it to everyone. So we had people with their salaries changing with multiple times. And these are scary changes. And each system was better than the last, but that doesn't change the impact of, oh my God, everything is changing around here continually. God. The process we used to sense and respond was continually changing itself.
Yeah. Could you talk more about that process of the process that you used to sense and respond? Like, can you dial in more concretely to what that looked like in the early stages?
Yeah, well, even we talk about agile software development. Agile is not a single methodology. It's a family of principles and techniques for software development that all have this sense and respond paradigm to them. Mm. So we had to find specific practices to do and embody these principles. Yep. And there are many different agile methods out there, each with their own processes. We tried many, and then the ones we tried, well, you know, we weren't satisfied with them, so we'd continue tweaking. We'd continue changing the very process by which we try to embody these principles. So all of that was continually evolving, continually in flux. And there were times where we didn't have a process to do it, so we would rely on heroic leadership to step in and just hold it and do it. Mm. And then people were swamped by that capacity, especially we had some very smart but quite young and inexperienced folks there. And then everything's changing constantly, and sometimes it was difficult to keep up with the pace of just how fast things were unfolding and evolving.
And Agile is a very specific process for software development. But beyond that, especially at the time, there wasn't really much to be said outside. Some of the up-and-coming stuff was just barely on product management, and that was sort of the newest thing. And even Agile, it's been around a while, but when we first started Ternary, it was just kind of starting to get its legs, and didn't even have a reputation yet. It was like the new maverick reputation at that point. So definitely everybody was still learning Agile, even, you know, as it was getting out there.
Lex, it isn't a specific process. It's a family of processes.
Yeah.
So,
right.
And those specific methods within that family are pretty specific, but that was even the early days, even when they were still evolving on top of our evolution of them.
And
Lex's point, that was just about software development and project management, and even that was a leading edge for that movement at the time. So we were then taking it and trying to apply it to everything we did, and we were looking at, you know, I was doing our finance and accounting, saying, how can I get this more agile? So it was continual. And then somewhere along the way, as we grew and we got larger than the heroic leadership could sustain it, there was only so much you could hold and do, and we got big enough that a heroic leader couldn't themselves hold a space to integrate all of the different voices and perspectives into those experiments. And we realized we needed some kind of collaborative decision-making methods here. It's easy enough to get there through some kind of heroic leadership combined with consensus when you're small.
Right.
Still simple in hindsight compared to what we have now, but we grew to a point where that didn't work. So then we went out looking for collaborative decision-making methods and tried to find ways of what we didn't have the language for at the time, but governing and decision-making processes, that kind of stuff we went looking for.
And so we started with consensus, and which worked until we ended up with trying to set our company mission with the whole company, 13 people, and it took us 2 days. And there was arguing about whether or not we should use the word the or the word a, and it just, it became very clear that it was just too many people, just, and too, and some people didn't care, and some people did, and it was just, it was just, and that, I think it was a good lesson for us to learn. It only took us 2 days with 13 people to figure it out, but that was definitely something,
Well, it raises a really, one of my burning questions for you guys, which is, how did you know that something was working?
So I think a lot of that was gut feel. There was, which makes sense. What we were doing is taking a capacity that the founders of that company had individually, and we were trying to instill it in the organization. So that became easy enough to just judge by your own internal compass, especially with three of us. So less risk of one person's bias getting in the way. And three of us with very different types, very different energies that had lenses to make sure it wasn't our own biases. Not to say they didn't slip in at times, but with that, it was like taking the capacity that we held very intuitively from our own development and trying to instill that capacity in the organization. So a lot of how did we know was just gut feel based on that capacity. Then there are the external measures as well. Is it working? Is it working for delivering results to our clients? Is it working for building the business and generating new business and revenue? Is it working in our sales process? Do clients want this capacity? So we had all those methods as well, though I think the first and foremost was an internal check across the three founders and then some others that got involved in that with us over time.
I think we're also able to bounce it off of the models as we, strangely, and this is where I would call it bad science, but it worked. Especially, I mean, agile software development is genius in its own right, but the underlying paradigm is not, I think, new to the world. A lot of times we'll talk about things, it's sort of just, there's kinship. Holacracy has a lot of kinship with that. It's the same principles really underlying it. It's the same paradigm shift. But, and a lot of times, and that's just where we happen to get a lot of the paradigm shift for us. A lot of people, you know, they say, oh, Holacracy's just like blah, 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 or was this an influence? And it sometimes it's not. It's just really a good idea. It's just the way the world is going. And Agile, so we could push, you know, some of the principles. Does this sense and response sounds like a really good idea? Let's, you know, tight feedback loops, good idea. And you see that in a lot of different, I mean, that's systems theory right there.
For example, a lot of what Agile principles, the paradigm, is the same paradigm Peter Senge is pointing to with learning organization. It's the same paradigm the conscious capitalism movement is pointing to with the way they treat stakeholders. It's the same paradigm. GTD, getting things done, that method. It's a method of individual organization. I found, must have been about 4 years into the journey at Ternary or something, and then and it was the roots of it, I had intuited myself some pieces of it, but then I found a method that was vastly more well thought out than what I had kind of cobbled together. So I adopted that wholesale, recognizing it as another expression of the same principles. So I look at GTD and I see this is the same damn underlying paradigm that Agile software is trying to organize around, that Holacracy is trying to organize around. So it's like none of these are, this underlying paradigm is not, it's not a theory, it's not a mental model, it's just closer to reality. It's stripping away theories. What GTD does that's so brilliant is strip away all our artificial ways of trying to organize and get us to something that's more close to reality and natural. Same thing with Agile. It tries to strip away all our artificial predict and control constructs and get us down to just more ruthlessly facing reality. Same with Holacracy. So that's the direction here. It's not building a theory. It's stripping away stuff to get to something more to an essence of a new paradigm, and then trying to build organic structures around that that help that paradigm take flesh and express in the world. So with all of these, and again, GTD also influenced then the development. Using GTD individually, it contributed directly to Holacracy by giving more clear definitions of next action and project. It contributed to Holacracy more clearly by helping us understand what was needed in that, the outputs of operational meetings, things like that. It also tied directly to what was going on in the Agile world, lots of connections between the two there. And the underlying mode of thought of GTD is one of getting clarity. And that's the same thing with Holacracy. And I think it was part of the influence, as holding GTD and using GTD shaped my own thinking. And that helped as Holacracy tried to achieve some of the similar effects across the whole organization. How do we have a process that forces us to get clarity, which is what GTD does? It holds a framework that allows us to get clarity. So a lot of that thinking gets integrated as we try to say, how do we do the same thing at a different level for Holacracy?
So that
was an influence.
Right. And so GTD really helped with kind of the tactical operational end of things. What kind of catalyzed the governance space and around that?
Expand that to give due credit to GTD. It was even beyond that. That was its most obvious direct.
Yes.
But I think the underlying thought process of that, which is how do we take stuff that shows up, tensions in our language, and process them into clarity?
Mm.
Right. A lot of that thinking is so linked to what GTD does for an individual.
Yep.
So a lot of that was the same thing. Even in governance, it might not have had some of the same structures and the same level of detailed help for governance, but the thought process of facing stuff, tension, and getting that clearly processed into clarity. And the way of holding it certainly has echoes of GTD in it.
Mm-hmm.
But to answer your question then, on the governance side, as Lex said, first we tried a consensus-based process. That was a disaster. Then we found a model, I think it was called participative decision making, that was kind of a similar, it had a defined process for decision making. It had different bars you could set, including consensus-like bars, but it gave more definition to what that means.
Mm-hmm.
It was what I would say is a much more effective consensus-based process. And it scaled beyond just consensus-based processes. And that added something, but it was still really lacking for us. Then we just went Googling and looked for collaborative decision-making methods.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we ran into first Sociocracy,
mm-hmm.
Which had what they call a consent-based process to it. And the thing that actually grabbed us about Sociocracy at first, the structure, the organizational structure, was identical. The idea of self-organizing teams, although I sometimes get the impression the Sociocracy world feels like they invented that concept. It's not. It was what we were already doing with our teams, and it came right from the Agile space for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw, hey, here's a method that embraces self-organization already. Right? They added a cool piece to the structure, which was the idea of a double link, and we took that wholesale and said, yep, got it.
Mm.
Check. That just took our self-organizing teams and took it up a notch.
Yeah.
Sociocracy is also based on the systems theory, the sort of the feedback loops thing. So that really sunk in quick. We heard that in Scrum, which is an Agile methodology, feedback in extreme programming, and then Sociocracy is saying, use your tight feedback loops, get your sense, I can't always remember which pieces came from which. I was much more involved in the Agile software development stuff, but then the bicycle, they also had that metaphor. So it was from the book?
In the sociology
book. So then the structure and the hierarchy, the way they showed it with the double linking, and then some of Elliot Jack's work, I think I remember that's when Brian was starting to bring that in and throw that against that model. And the decision-making process was just so fantastic just the rules.
In Sociocracy, it was very similar to the participative decision-making process, but it upped it a notch. It got a little more clarity and structure, and the process I just liked a little better. It felt closer. So we experimented with that, and at first, when we first found it, it looked really cool, and my hope was it was completely aligned with what we were trying to do. So we said, let's dive into this, and we added the few pieces we didn't already have with the double link, and then upgraded our decision-making method to be this one. We even brought in a Sociocracy consultant for about 2 days to just kind of work with us and help, and he came in and said, wow, this is really weird. You guys read a book, but as far as I can tell, you're already doing this. Because it really wasn't from reading the book. We were already doing 80% of it, and we added and layered the next pieces on from that.
Mm-hmm.
So we went down that road, and It actually became clear after doing that for even just, I don't know, 6 or 12 months or something, that it was a nice incremental step forward, but it wasn't what we were looking for or going for. Though we certainly got a lot of value and integrated those pieces, what it didn't offer was a governance structure.
Gotcha.
Even though it's talked about or described as a governance, but it's not. It's a decision-making method.
Mm-hmm.
That was one. And the other is it was a decision-making method still grounded more in the people and our perspectives, and it didn't have the clarity of tension processing one tension at a time that we now see in Holacracy. Nor did it have rules around what an objection was. So they used the language objection, and in fact, a lot of the language of Sociocracy's consent process still shows up in Holacracy today, but the actual thinking method is very different.
I think the original language was, I didn't know when we moved from it, and I don't know why we moved from that at the time, but originally it was, instead of no objection, it's I consent.
Uh-huh.
And that was sort of the beginning piece of it. But the rounds and just the way the process was laid out and the election process was just fantastic.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think it was only just the slight tweak to the processes were all great. It was just like the underlying paradigm of how you approach whether or not what consent is was the piece. But even I think circle language was Sociocracy, and then that seemed like that meshed, the double linking meshed so well with the concept of a holarchy, which I'm not as familiar with. Brian was, I remember he was talking about that and just kind of bringing in those. Brian was doing a lot of integration of different models. So for me, it was very difficult to know what was coming from where. I would be like, well, so in Sociocracy, when you do this, and he's like, actually, that's from blah, blah, blah. And so it's really interesting to try to even parse this out. I'm curious what all this stuff's going to come out sometimes. But yeah, it was really a fundamental piece for structure and decision making.
Yeah.
I think at that.
Yeah, and what it added was a more structured decision making process than what we were using before, which was great.
Mm-hmm.
And one that it felt like the mechanics of that process were really good.
Mm-hmm.
What we needed to do was change some of the meaning of it underneath of it and some of the rules of the game.
Yep.
And then we needed it to be in a different context. So we needed to find outputs that governed and distributed authority as opposed to made specific decisions.
Gotcha.
So we then added a governance process largely of our own creation, and it was actually the third founder of Ternary that I think had a lot to do with the clarity of structure that led to roles and accountabilities mm-hmm. as an output of mm-hmm. governance.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of my work that went into how do we change use these mechanics of Sociocracy's consent process with different rules and meaning. Define objection, what's allowed, what's not, what does that mean, more structure each step so that it moved from more embracing the people at a more egoic level and moved to more organizational governance around the organization's purpose through humans as sensors. So that shift was something that we then took the mechanics of the process Sociocracy offered and added in lots of our own stuff and distilled down to how do we use these mechanics as a base framework in order to get one tension at a time processing around the organization's purpose with clarity of dynamic steering, so it's not try to solve everything all at once, which is what naturally was happening with Sociocracy's consent process. Everyone brings their tensions all at once, and it tends to feel a lot more like a consensus process, albeit a well-structured one, which is fine for what it is, but we were looking for something new. So we then matured that up, and that's where it was just lots of trial and error. There was, I would facilitate those meetings, and I would learn as I facilitated. Basically, every time I saw the opportunity for something to sneak in that was really not about the organization or that was hurting dynamic steering, it was at first intuitive,
mm-hmm.
and I just kind of started maturing up the way it got facilitated until it looks very different than what Sociocracy does. And then a later step that's actually only recent since Holacracy 1 started was me moving from, and this might have been 3 or 4 years ago the shift started, me moving from being able to do it intuitively to call out what I was doing.
Yes.
And to define the rules of the game rather than just doing the rules of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And getting that matured up further.
Yep.
So,
and even maturing up some of the stuff with roles. I mean, roles and accountabilities we had very early on, but even with the concept of scope, constraints around roles. And I think getting the real feel that every circle has and every role really fundamentally kind of needs an aim. I think we're still playing with that a little bit, but that really fleshed out. But one of the things I think we really found out quickly with sociocracy was that, I mean, the decision-making was very helpful, and we kind of needed to change some of the underlying paradigm to kind of go with what we were already kind of seeing, and I think what was just kind of pointing in that direction. But we really struggled with how to transform the outputs back into the organization. And I think they were starting to at least the consultant we were working with was starting to tease into that with transformation, but it wasn't quite going right back in. And I think that was where the beauty of the roles and accountabilities really came in, to say, here's how it goes back in. Here's how circles interconnect. Now you don't just have the double linking, you're actually building the structure as you go.
And what that means, so in sociocracy, you still get the same consultant we were working with and some of his materials. He says, in sociocracy, outside of their meetings where they use this process, the leader decides everything. The leader calls the shots, which is right back to a conventional heroic leadership paradigm. We wanted it to not just be in these meetings, but an entire distributed governance system, which is where we needed not just roles and accountabilities, but to know how that affected day-to-day work, right? So we needed a defined governance structure to distribute authority, so we didn't just have to say, sure, we make decisions collaboratively in these meetings, and then everything else is conventional, right? We wanted complete, distributed, clear governance that was all integrated. The other thing we did, and this is where integral theory started coming in, as an informing model, again, not a practice as much, but a model, realizing, you know, the idea of thinking of a circle as a group of humans is pushing against the paradigm that we were trying to express. And that's where the idea of holons and holarchy, and the idea that there's a holarchy here that has nothing to do with the people, it is the organization's holarchy. And then bringing in all the principles of holon, how holons are organized, how to think about that, bringing that in to kind of test or to look at our structure through and refine our understanding of the organizational structure and the governance structure for what we were actually governing, what a circle was, what the double links are. There's a huge difference between a holarchic circle structure of double links and, say, the connection between two organizations that are connected with links. That is not a holarchic relationship of include. It's a different type of relationship, and it means different things with what those links are, what they do, the governance. And this is now getting into some of the leading edge of, we're still documenting some of that in the Constitution's next version. Mm-hmm. So again, I should say, too, this has been much of this. There's so many different threads in parallel. I hope that's coming out. There were so many different pieces all kind of weaving together. Along with integral theory, some of Andrew Cohen's writings in evolutionary philosophy and evolutionary spirituality, and looking at that, also brought in some really powerful pieces for us to look at purpose and what that creative impulse was we were trying to organize around, and then how to get what we might call transpersonal space in the governance meetings. Mm-hmm. So that was all the process work was with those lenses held, trying to get not just lenses, that was there too, but the feel, the felt sense of it. Trying to move to a space where you really have the organization's voice, a more direct, its purpose, its creative impulse, its whatever, expressing through without our stuff getting in the way. So that was kind of an overarching frame.
I think, ironically, it's the operational pieces that lagged behind. I mean, granted, the governance pieces were so much harder, but Agile really gives you a lot to work with in that, and especially when you're running a software development company, it really applies to software developers. So it's very easy just to use those operational practices. So when we were in Holacracy 1, I think Tom was really instrumental in bringing a lot of the operational practices to maturity. And with the GTD, I saw a lot more of that come out. As opposed to just informing it, it just really started to pop a lot more.
Well, that was another thread. Patrick Lencioni's work actually was really influential as well. At first, we didn't have the differentiation between governance and operations. Then we did. We differentiated it, but we didn't have an operational meeting practice other than the ones provided by Agile Software Development. methods.
Right.
We had governance process, and we had the differentiation, governance and operations, but we didn't have a meeting process and distinctions for operations.
Gotcha.
And then we used Patrick Lencioni's meeting process, which became our tactical meeting. It's now diverged some and matured up, but originally it was that.
Yep.
And then we used David Allen's work with GTD to define the outputs of that much more clearly than Lencioni's work did.
Mm.
So, you know, we got David Allen's concepts of project and next action and what they mean and the focus in them integrated into Patrick Lencioni's tactical meeting process, all within a frame of governance so we know clear roles, clear authorities to decide what projects and actions to take and to execute in them. So it was like these threads, it was really a weaving process is how it felt.
Yeah. So as we come down to the end of our hour here, I thought it might be helpful to just kind of repeat, you know, some of the core themes that you've mentioned, see if there's anything really missing, and then I'd love to leave a few minutes for questions from our participants if there's any. But so far I've heard you mention, you know, Agile, obviously, the learning organization, GTD, integral type, from Linda Behrens, Barry Oshry's work, Elliot Jack's integral theory, evolutionary philosophy, and
Patrick Lencioni's work.
Gerard Annenberg with Sociocracy.
Gerard Annenberg's work there. Actually, let's mention Elliot Jacks. There were some parts of his work that are about as predict and control as it comes, but there are other parts that are brilliant.
Yeah.
So there were some influences there.
Yeah. So is there anything else that, you know, really stands out as super salient contributions to the work?
You know, but there's such pressure in that question for me that I take there's been so much that has contributed in different ways. I always worry I'm missing somebody and not thinking of somebody. It embodies so many of these things that if I forget somebody, I'm at risk of somebody saying, "Hey, you used that and didn't credit it."
Yeah.
And sometimes it looks
What's also really hard is that sometimes you don't really know where something came from somebody else. There's a lot of practices in Agile software development that came from somewhere else that we started to pick up and there's just a lot of stuff that a lot of different people are doing just because it's a good idea. So it's just where you got it from, not necessarily who originated it. Who knows who originated it? Could have been nobody.
So we're missing some due credit. One of the cool things about this, well, actually, there's a quote. I forget whose quote it is, but it's the test of originality. The test for originality in an idea is not the absence of predecessors. It's the presence of multiple but incompatible predecessors. And I think that, to me, really speaks to what Holacracy does in terms of its history and development. There are a lot of different predecessor methods out there. And from any one of their lenses, Holacracy looks like it embodies what they offer. And then there's some other stuff that might be perceived as pushing against, although I don't think so. What it does is take so many different things and weaves them together. The originality in Holacracy is not any one component. It is a way of integrating and holding multiple but incompatible predecessors all at once, all simultaneously, and getting all that value expressed. And that's the originality. It's an emergent originality. The whole of Holacracy is not reducible to its parts in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, for sure. Great. Well, I just thought I'd mention that we'll have more chances to kind of revisit all of these components and a wrap-up call. So if you think of other contributors that you'd like to mention, there'll be more chances. And just want to open the floor for questions or comments from any of our participants. Bernard Marie has one comment here. I think that the biggest contributor to Holacracy is all the tensions felt by ternary staff and integrated. Is that how you'd comment on that?
Yeah, you know, I don't know, but it does occur to me that we don't want to miss that. I mean, a lot of the little things, tweaks here and there, came from lots of people at ternary suffering through all of the experimentation. So I don't know how to rank that in the grand scheme of things, but it was certainly a incredible contribution that many people there offered. So that was part of it. And not just ternary. Holacracy has absolutely evolved. In fact, many people who were at ternary, even late in the development of it there, would probably look at Holacracy today and say, oh my God, this thing looks extremely different because it is. It's continued to evolve, and it continues to evolve, although now more in the nuances. It's deepening, but the early days of Holacracy One, early years, had just as much evolution of this, big chunks, big ways. Yeah. Tom added a whole lot of force to that evolution as well.
We actually had started with another company early on, too, where Brian was helping them try Holacracy, and I think we learned a lot from that, too. So there were outside parties that were experimented on and gave themselves over. But, yeah, I mean, it was a lot of contribution by censors for people, and there are a lot of people that it's hard to even remember who what, but little ideas here and there that just came in that if they'd written a paper, you would know where it was from, but you could almost just assume that anybody at Ternary probably contributed something that you're actually using day to day. But it did really formalize a lot more once we started Holacracy One. And especially at the end of the days of Ternary, I think people were getting tired of it.
Totally.
They were ready to move on.
Yeah, for sure. Great. Well, do any of our participants have any other questions for Lex or Brian at this time?
I see a question here we missed, I think, a little while back. Would you advise your consultancy clients in the process of adopting Holacracy to disclose to their clients how they're doing things differently? I don't know. It's an intriguing question. At Ternary, we did, and it became a huge competitive advantage because we put it in the client's terms, why it mattered to them. If you can do that, if you can put it in terms of why it matters to them, I think that's really powerful. If not, then it's only going to work if they're aligned philosophically, in which case, then it can be cool. Similar mindsets here. But I think those are your two paths. Either you get clients that are a very similar mindset and you use it to show them that, or you put it in their language and their benefits and their terms. I think it's an interesting, intriguing option. Don't know that I have a clear yes or no. It depends. But,
Great. Well, I'm certainly looking forward to further evolution and curious to see where Holacracy will go. And thanks for being here to all of our participants and to Lex and Brian. And we'll be continuing the conversation in probably mid-November with our next call. So stay tuned and we'll continue.
Great. Right. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Lex.
Yes, take care.
Thank you so much.
Bye.
Bye.